โมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิHow people's energies are after a hard day of thrashing out the calm. I'll talk a bit about being in the community context, since this is where we are.And it's just noticing myself coming over from Britain and doing teaching retreat at Spirit Rock, which was a meditation retreat, and quite enjoyable in its own way. I enjoy meditating. I like, being with people in this context, and brings up ideas and reflections.And yet always I'm struck by these retreat centre contexts. As we always feel this means a lot more people need here than can be done in a retreat. The very form of the retreat and the sense of the retreat tends to create a kind of a definition of the practice subliminally, That is, one feels a practice is something that occurs when you go to a particular place, and it's within certain structures and postures, and it's done in silence, and it's done without really being much connected to anybody else. You're there on your own with 60 other people, with a strange sense of kind of ignoring them and yet realizing they're there.Which makes you generally feeling slightly irritated by everybody else. So one is in one's own capsule, as it were. And it seems that actually is quite stressful for people, in that encapsulated state. These things feel quite tight.Things kind of build up, cook up. Something just needs to flow, something needs to be able to move, and yet be within boundaries. Be within boundaries where you can get reflection, where you can sense your boundaries, where you get guidance, where you sense limitations and you work within things. But to be able to extend the four foundations of mindfulnessinto something that one can live within, rather than, say, just sit within in silence. And this is the particular thing that I feel monasteries are about, where perhaps the conditions in some ways can seem less ideal, in terms of, the it's not so polished as a retreat centre, it's not soemphatically silent as a retreat centre. It's not so simple in a way as a retreat centre. And yet, it does present one with a model of life, and recognising that actually there weren't any retreat centres at the time of the Buddha either. And everybody's out there doing it, or the people who were practising were doing it in forests, being bitten by things, and presumably...having to live in a living context. Although it's not to, you know, dismiss retreat centers which have their values and purposes, but just saying, well, these are places where we can perhaps pump up certain aspects of our practice and get a lot of teachings, and yet recognize we still have to come back to living context in which to work out the Four Noble Truths, suffering, be able to meet our suffering. First truth, to meet and recognize it, not be blind to it, but really acknowledge it, meet it, not be bounce off it, not just project it out, not blame it on others, not distract oneself. We're going to meet that. Because it's in meeting this that we can understand or get to terms with come to grips with the origin of it, and then when the origin of it is understood, it can be released or relaxed, and the cessation, the settling, the calming down, the quietening, the release from that, and the path becomes increasingly clear. And it's always one where we're actually handling aspects of our karma, of what we've inherited, of the way we perceive the world, which is part of our karma, the very filters that we place in our eyes, our ears, over our senses, over our hearts and minds. How do we perceive things? This is inherited. This is something that's been built up over time. What things mean to us, how things are registered for us, whether things feel friendly or unfriendly or intense or whatever, threatening or joyful. There's a certain amount of perceptual filtering that goes on that gives us these signals, and we need to know how many of these are accurate, how many of these are just past luggage, things that have been built up in the past that actually have long outlived their usefulness. And once we can recognize, well, they may have been useful at one time, but they're no longer relevant, we can discard and lighten up our inheritance, our life luggage. And also, we can also consider ways in which, or begin to understand ways in which we don't get the knee-jerk reflexes of creating more karma based upon how we see, interpret the world, ourself, our bodies, our minds, other people, and so on. We don't need to go into the panic or the anxiety or the irritation or the sorrow or the grief or the various degrees of ricochet that occur that is the creation of new karma that then embeds us into particular patterns and interpretations of ourselves and others, and so on, this whole mass of suffering. So to be able to meet one's suffering itself is considered, this is clarity, vision, knowledge, insight, wisdom. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta lists these, what arises with just even understanding that one's suffering is to be met rather than to be run away from, or something's wrong here, you know, I shouldn't be suffering, something's going wrong here. But to recognize, oh, this is a good sign, you know, if I can meet this. And just to get that amount of understanding is considered some degree of realization. And then one is meeting it, one is handling it, one is holding it, one is wrapping one's awareness around that. This is, you know, while we struggle with that, this is a sign of realization, you know, that it is something we can actually handle. We're not victims, we're not helpless, we're not flawed by it. We don't have to come up with immediate solutions to our suffering. We can say, okay, well, I wrap my mind and heart, my awareness around this and explore it, penetrate it and work with it. And then one does begin to understand that or penetrate it. And then, oh, it's based upon this. So this is the way that we work. And clearing out karma. So another very summary of the Buddhist path is I teach karma and the end of karma. Buddhist teaching, as long as there's one is still oppressed by past karma and still generating fresh karma, there's no end to stress and suffering. So if we're just always creating new karma, this means that every new moment we come in with some take on it already before it's happened. We're already pushing it somewhere. We're already pushing our lives ahead rather than seeing them unfold. We're already coming with an agenda. We're already coming with a desire. We're coming with an anxiety. We're coming with some fear. We're coming with some frustration. So, based upon that, we then perceive the world or set up what we're going to do, and we haven't really undermined those roots that push us along. And even as we don't recognize that we haven't taken away the roots of that, there still comes in this idea, this thought, if I just act upon this, I will get to the end of it in the future. So it's really important to realize that in the what's called the present pachupana dhamma, the present arising, that it's only in the present that you actually take out the arrow, the dart of suffering. It's only in the present that the karma finishes. It's never finished in the future. You only can undercut that triggering in the present. There's no and then. This is a nice thing to say, easy enough to say, but it's also I do want to recognize how often many things are not. I don't personally don't examine everything that clearly. So a lot of this karma gets created in a surreptitious and not really clear way. So I was noticing in my monastic life, most of that life has been around building monasteries. So about 25 years of it. So like living on a building site for 25 years with a feeling of, oh, we'll just get this done and then... So that started back in 1979, so it's not 25, but it seems like it. Seems like a lot more than that. We'll just get this sorted out, with a bit of work to do, and then. Yeah, okay, so... Still that vague feeling that well, then we'll get this done, and then... And we'll tidy this up and knock that down, and then... And then we'll build this up and fix that, and then... And then we'll just tidy that and plant that, and then... And then maybe we'll redecorate that, and da-da-da, and then... I think, what's this and then bit? it's always this not really clearly articulated feeling that one, it will stop. It's never stopped. It's remained about the same. It's maybe got from being hardcore grubby into being a little more refined, but basically the same thing. It's never stopped. There's still people walking around with bits of paper in their hand muttering about tongue groove and cement and plaster, and there's still people kind of wondering about bills and budgets, and there's still people saying, oh, it's too much work, we hurry up, we can only get this done by Friday, and it's still going on, in the sense of, well, maybe this could all stop. When it all gets finished, this will all stop, won't it? But I've noticed even in places, or when monks come from monasteries where there isn't a lot of work, like people who come from Sri Lanka, where they don't have much work to do, then they come to monasteries and start creating work. they do things like an analysis of the prosody of the Pali Canon. Or, why? structural, looking into the structure of various texts or something. I mean, why? There's a So this sort of this karmic stuff is like a rolling ball. It just, and something in us feels that if we just keep rolling this ball, it'll take us to the good place, the satisfied place, the completed place, the place of fulfillment. And we roll on that ball for lifetimes. Then, of course, I think meditation gets affected very much in the same way, doesn't it? Well, you know, start meditating and then, you know, a couple of years. Well, they say it takes a while, so a couple of years, and then, you know. They definitely say it takes quite a bit of time, so maybe 10 years, and then. Well, you know, 20 years, and then. So after about 25 years, you're thinking, maybe it isn't going to be in then. Maybe this is it, you know. What's wrong? You know, I ask that question to myself. What actually, this present moment, is preventing me feeling okay? Then it becomes more interesting, because these shadow and thens, which are never really clearly defined, and the suffering or the irresolution, because it's not often anguish, it's a sense of, you know, something better than this, or wish that wasn't happening, becomes highlighted, and one goes into recognizing, oh, here's just some desire or frustration or anxiety, none of it. Anxiety, not or frustration, or being irritated by sounds or sights, or irritated by thoughts, or anxious about things that haven't arisen yet, or anxious about things that might be arising, or anxious about things that have arisen that haven't yet been completed. So one could be anxious about the past, the future, and the present, and making, you know, and follow those anxiety trends, you know, and let them proliferate onto what he's doing and she's doing and they should be and I, what will happen then and what's happening in September 2009. And are we still in line with the teachings that happened 2,500 years ago? Perhaps we're moving away, perhaps we're declining, perhaps we're degenerating. That's probably it. And so with the anxiety or that kind of thing, I begin to recognize is quite frequent thing in my own karma. And so it'd be much easier for me to imagine that things have degenerated since over the years rather than they've actually improved. So the karma, the anxiety over things going on can get backdated into the past. Things must have been perfect at one time and now they're less than that because there's something wrong. You know, things are okay in the present but they're not going to last. Mm. And in the future there'll be things are going to be worse. That's very easy for my mind to move into that. So it's always refreshing when you look into the scriptures and particularly look in the books of the Vinaya and think, oh, it's a mess then too. That's a relief, isn't it? Even the Buddha couldn't sort it out. And even the Buddha, around teaching and innumerable occasions, there's people fouling it up, you know, corruption, sexual perversions, people badgering lay folk for honey and cloth and it's like that, really, really scummy stuff, you know, going on. And the Buddha patiently saying, misguided man, have I not told you this life is... a great deal of more respect arises for me from reading the Buddha in the Vinaya than even in the Buddha in the suttas, because you realize that here's the Buddha actually in the day life context of people fouling it all up. And not losing it, not going ballistic, or thinking this is all a waste of time, or how's this thing ever going to keep going, over the next thousands of years, just keeping it in the moment and saying what needs to be said, and kind of just not creating any more karma for himself. So actually when one begins to just get the sense of what the future could be, or what the past was, or what the present is, we may begin to open up and reveal, I feel, some of the roots of unexplained or unexposed dukkha. And the dukkha that is present as well, you know, that does seem to be exposed, to be able to handle and hold that and explore into that. Like, what really is the root of this? What is the, what's the push behind this? This is what these places are about. You know, create a holding space for daily life experience where one can be irritated or disappointed, slightly frustrated or confused or anxious about many things, because monasteries are very insecure in many ways. You know, financially, psychologically, people are going through this stuff. We never really know quite what's going to be happening in the next month. So they're likely to live on that edge in which the insecurity and the inconstancy of it all can help to reveal as one's current potential to try to control it, to make it work, to feel you're not doing good enough because otherwise it'll all be settled and calmed down and steady. To, you know, the anger or rage at having to be in a position of trying to do it. So being leader of community, for myself anyway, there's always these kinds of things are coming up. Sense of, oh, you know, why do I have to deal with all this stupid stuff? You know, all I told you to do is just watch my breath and, you know, things will be all right. You know, bother me with all this stupid stuff. So I get, you know, some anger, rage, or anxiety over not being able to make it work, and so on. And so just kind of coming into that. This emotional material, which is the where we really touch the living charge, the living current, the voltage of dukkha. So rather than letting it spin out into ideas about what I should be or the way it should be and so on, nor dismissing those, but being able to unwrap them and feel into the anxiety or the irritation or the sadness that's there. This is the karma that I'm handling. I was noticing just coming here a couple of days ago from a fairly intense talkathon at a teachers' conference, which had its own joys and irritations, like most things. Coming in feeling rather shot by it all, a bit shot away, bleary, tumbling out of the vehicle. I didn't realize it so far, because when you look on the map of America, I mean, Bayagiri is sitting more or less on top of San Francisco. So you put it in British terms, you think it looks like about 15 miles. I'll be here any moment now. Why are they going this long way around? So by the time we got here, it was quite late in my little world anyway, and feeling quite tired. We come into the hall and sit down. Quite goodness, it's silent. Silence, you know, it hadn't been silent for many days. Silence. Yeah, paying respects. Yeah. And then the silence, so revealing. And then that sense of what's happening, what's going on. You know, the mind reaching out for what's where, what. And then the little anxiety coming up. Am I doing the right? Am I got it right? Am I the right? Am I doing the right thing? Have I got my clothes on right? Have I got my not sitting on somebody's seat and some terrible faux pas in accordance with the core what or whatever? You know, I feel all right. You know, and then, what's happening? Virgin Parra says, "Oh, it's pretty quiet." Yeah. What's been? Yeah. And then somebody asks somebody else, "Yeah, it's fairly quiet." And, a quiet day. Last week it was quiet. I think, yes. And that medium for this quiet space. And then very, very nice. I can feel this, the trembling of my own awareness, you know, trying to find a place to rest or settle, or just making that sense of just quiet. Oh. And then being able to just in that moment, just hold the edge of that flutter, let it be there, and breathe it out. Mm. Having to come up with something, push it away, distract myself, or run out the door, or anything.
Yes.
Oh. Mm. And it's very helpful. Mm. Not having to add a whole lot more stuff, you know, information, history, stories, things to do, even all kind of elaborate ways of making one feel welcome, just very simple. Maybe ask me what I want to eat tomorrow, what kind of drink I'd like. Maybe ask me where I've been, just quiet. Mm. The nervous, that tremble, that so often happens when you meet people or old friends or even new people, that tremble of trying to, how's this going to work, how are we with each other, what's going on? Just feel that and just relax. Oh. This is what monasteries are about. The seeming coolness of response. Not coldness, but actually part of the, if you like, the therapy of monasteries. So you can feel your own stuff. Don't be blamed, don't feel bad about it. Nobody's gonna, you know, you don't have to explain it, just feel your own stuff. Give yourself time. Nothing's asked of you. Just sit there, feel it, breathe it, know what it is, relax. Oh, feel better now. One's drop from being up in the head to down in the body, and the happiness of that is being a body, and the happiness of all the kind of personal histories and projects and agendas and da 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 da. Just being able to drop all that and be here in the body, and how wonderful walking out of the hall and the night sky, and feeling clear and settled and very much welcomed without very much having happened, without a lot of explanations or stories, just being welcomed by the very quality of what, a presence, of a holding quiet presence. Oh, this is different, isn't it? This is different from doing something about it. This is different from talking about it even. This is different from meditating on it. You know, this is just releasing it. Mm. And when that little emotional charge, which wasn't very much actually, just a little flutter, whenever that's released, the little bit of space opens up. So the external space or the external quiet holding space becomes an internal quiet, where before there was some movement and some nervousness or some doubt or some irritation. Oh, now there's some internal space, there's some emptying. How lovely that is. That was much better than having something else put in there to make that funny feeling go away. That was much better than having, you know, a sense object or a thought or an idea put in there, put on top of it. Much better was just to feel it and be given the opportunity to open to that and release it. Mm. You know, that, with that sense of inner space, the world seems fresh and bright. I see this as our main occupation, is generating space. This is, I feel, the most important, you know, core thing for contemplatives, and I suppose summoners in particular, because we have that mandate, if you like, or we, because of our powerlessness, relative powerlessness, then the emphasis is very much one on generating space. You can't generate children, you can't generate money, you can't generate much, but you can generate space. So that's the emphasis. And doing this through touching karma and holding it carefully, confidently, nothing wrong with you, just that's a feat, that's what was supposed to be happening, and being able to release it. These systems, these embodied consciousness experiences that we're in, are wired. They're wired, they're emotionally wired, they're sensitively wired, they're wired in terms of being affected and responding. That's the way they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be wired for security, so they have fear in them. They're supposed to be wired for protection, so they have rage in them. They're supposed to be wired to find what's pleasant and agreeable, so they have desire in them. They're supposed to be that way. Nothing wrong with them. But the whole, there's a difference between things being something wrong with it and being holding it, you know, from this embodied consciousness. If those emotional charges, those emotional voltage is released, then something rather more far-reaching than fear, what we can get through fear, desire or anger can arise. Called the supreme security, the supreme happiness. And I guess this is really, you know, underneath all the complexities of the way we think, we come down to some very primal emotive patterns, the need to feel secure, to feel safe, feel protected, to feel, you know, one will not be attacked or mocked at, either mentally attacked or emotionally attacked or physically attacked, you know, and that's just there in the system. The one will be able to find some sense of ease or enjoyment or warmth, whether it's emotional or, you know, psychological, whether it's something we feel happy with others, we feel, you know, peace with other people, that makes us feel, that's a pleasant place to be. Or whether it's just getting enough food to eat. So, in this our systems are like that, they're wired in that particular way, and they're wired up to context. This is the way we are. We're wired to context. And every context we're in, we're going to be getting those kind of tremblings on our fine antennae. Is it okay here? Is it okay here? Am I okay here? Am I doing something that people don't like here? Yeah. Will it be something I'll be blamed for here? That kind of tremble is going to be occurring. And with all the fine gradations of human behavior, you know, we're looking at ways in which I might be causing offense, something like that. So I don't want to do that, because then bad moods, bad words, bad thoughts will come my way. And the other one is, you know, is there something where I can derive enjoyment, happiness, ease, where I can feel contented? Is that happening here? So, and so many times we need to just be checking that, or recognizing that thing operating in us. in each context that we're in, and knowing what can be done. You know, there's no way I can be protected from old age, sickness, death. No way I can be protected from unpleasant sensations, ultimately. So we very much base it upon the mind being protected from greed, hatred, delusion, being protected by sila, using that as something where we can feel, I have this, this is my shield, this is my safe place, I can abide somewhere where I don't have to act on that, on immoral actions where people not act immorally towards me, in that sense. And then within that, well, okay, so people are still going to irritate me, but, you know, that I will learn to just feel that and release the suffering of that. So we've got ground to stand on, we have protection. We have safety in that respect. We also have a place of enjoyment and contentment. There'll be shelter here. Monastery is always places where you can get at least food and water free. And what's there is there for everybody. That's really something, isn't it, when you think of it? It's not, you know, that really is something in this particular, in this society, which is so, everything has to be paid for. So just living in a realm of dana, of generosity and sharing, itself is a source of, oh, there is something for me, you know. There is a sense of both the requisites itself and the attitude behind it. Not just the physical requisite, the attitude behind it. There's a sense in which people are attuned to common human needs and would like to share what they have with all of us. And to dwell in that. So simple things like that are things that very often we have to reflect on, because we can forget that. And if we don't take refuge fully and bring that up in our minds, the tendency for our own karmic propensity to shroud all that, to not see that, to no longer see that. So we forget that. Or it doesn't seem to mean very much. This is because of the particular nature of the emotive charge. You know, if we look into the experience of the embodied consciousness, so this is embodied as rupa, consciousness, vijnana, and then when you look at the five aggregates, you have sanya, vedana, or vedana, sanya, sankara. Vedana is the feeling, pleasure and pain. Sanya is the felt meaning, what things mean, how they're perceived or how they're interpreted. And sankara is the karma formation itself, which is the volitional kick. You know, it's the push. It's an energetic, it's a forming thing. And around feeling, it's not a lot we can do. You know, it just happens. You feel what you feel, there it is. Perceptions or sanya, again, it's what you're wired to. It's been imprinted. You know, men in uniforms make me feel this way. You know, you've got some kind of sanya there. So the real point that we can work on is the sankara, which is where those perceptions and those feeling that comes up can be, instead of being activated, can be discharged. So we may sense, for example, we might sense in monasteries the relative space or quietness or non-communication that can occur. People aren't necessarily all that forthcoming, it can be quite quiet. We may sense that as unfriendly. Actually, nobody's saying anything unfriendly or doing anything unfriendly or threatening us or cursing us or whatever. We can feel, oh, I just don't feel very comfortable here. People seem a bit a bit cold or a bit distant or a bit remote or whatever. That's the sanya, that's the meaning that's lodged there. Now we can hold that instead of acting upon it or trying to make it go away. Just, oh, well, there's a bit of anxiety there. As we begin to check into some of our mistrust, which is a strong word, but I think is there for all of us in human context, because of course human beings do each other a lot of damage, a lot of harm. So we see a human being that isn't always necessarily good news, unless you get particular, you know, positive overtures. Hi, Joe, it's great to see you. Da 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 da. You know, so if you don't get like, oh, I don't know where I am with this. And then people who don't say things are often people who you might find threatening. But then we begin to kind of unpick that, or just hold the sense of the nervousness, or the mistrust, or the feeling unwelcome. And then, there it is. And check it out. And it, just that little bit of suffering. Just that little bit. Because if we can release that, or if we can hold that and feel the charge of it and just breathe in and out and breathe through that, the little bit of space that gets opened up in there is our immediate liberation from just a little piece of this whole momentum of karma. And it's rather like that's where you see the results of practice, just there. And you begin to understand the path is not in not having perceptions or mistrusts or whatever, you know, and feeling, oh, terrible shame, I should be this way. No, it's about, that's the vipaka, that's what's happened, and you see the path is one of holding that and not generating fresh karma around it and being able to release that. The sankhara itself is in, I don't know how much energy got left, but I can go on. The aspect of that is that what's called volition, which is the push, you know, it's the reflex that go away, run, freeze, fight, flight, the little trigger, the volition. So that's an aspect of it. Another aspect of it is called attention, which is the focus, whether we get narrow focus, obsessive, spaced out, distracted, you know, whether your attention drifts off to something else or whether it holds onto something, grips it hard and goes into it in detail or whatever, that's attention. And the other one is impression, which means how we immediately resonate with something, and around this is the karma. The impression is very much bound up with perception and feeling. That's how it all operates. I was saying to Ajahn Pasano earlier when I was looking at the book of Ajahn Chah's teachings, Being Dharma, how I looked at that book and, you know, got a little bit of stress arising over seeing Paul Breiter's use of Sanskrit and Pali. You know, so sometimes he'll, because he's used the word Dharma, which is a Sanskrit word, but that's the way that normally it's used in America. You know, they didn't talk about Dhamma, they're Dharma. So they've taken the Sanskrit form. So it's obviously felt, well, that's the form we use Dharma, which is Sanskrit. And then, but then some of the words he's using a technical word. So he starts off with a Pali bit, and he puts this word Dharma on the end of it, which is Sanskrit. So the beginning begins in Pali, ends in Sanskrit. And this may not mean much to you, actually. But it really gets me going. So all this book of Ajahn Chah's teachings about detachment, dispassion, letting go, the main thing that I remember is this particular point. And so this means attention. You know. Attention has somewhat lost the plot here. What, you know, supposed to be attending to, you know, talking about Sila Samadhi Panya. Instead it's got stuck onto typesetting. And it's partly my editorial karma. But that's what attention does, you know. Obviously, you know, you could say that this is used in this way is slightly incorrect. But attention feels something that it doesn't feel comfortable with and just holds it and focuses on it and focuses right in on that and channels right in on that, and the rest of the book has disappeared. And then, you know, Paul Bright, a complete idiot, doesn't know what he's doing. He spent years and years translating these texts from Thai and doing his wonderful work, and then the attention fixes on that, and, you know, one creates a perception based on that. Okay, so we can laugh at that. What are yours? Much of monastic life is dealing with this very thing, you know, about whether you shave your eyebrows or not. Really, you know, very heated. Sitting cloths and cheese and minor matters of monastic etiquette, which tremendous amounts of passion can get aroused over. But it's partly, you know, in there, there's somewhere behind it all, there's basically love, you know. I want this to be really nice and right and perfect and beautiful and flawless. And everybody, you know, that's what I'm really behind it all. And then, yeah, you know, but that's a very nice wish. Very beautiful wish. But you won't find it in that place. This is the place of cooperation and uncertainty and working it through and letting go. You don't find it on the conditioned plane. You don't find it. But the quality of love and aspiration that we all have is just as the food to bring us up to, because there is this, just giving yourself the encouragement to bear with that little irritating, disappointing way it shouldn't be, and using that. And how to keep our attention, something we're mindful of our attention. Looks like getting a bit bogged down here. You know, let's back up a bit, let's loosen up around that one, let's get some perspective on that, come on, you know. Or if it's getting too, sometimes it gets too fuzzy and casual, let's sharpen the edge here, you know. But taking responsibility for attention, what one attends to, and intention, what kind of volitions come up. You know, whether we go, you know, utterly crazy over some, or frantic over some particular peccadillo, minor flaw. Then this way we're liberating ourselves from karma. So monastic life and what these situations open up to, which we, you know, that lay congregation are welcome to be part of this communal cooperative. For this particular purpose. We may see or imagine community life in various ways. We have to understand that. What are the perceptions that arise around it? Maybe this could be a really wonderful place. It's a good place where I felt, you know, could really belong. Okay, watch that one. This is a place where I could really do a lot of meditation practice. Nice idea. This is a place where all my doubts will be resolved. Careful. This is a place where, you know, new form of Dharma in the West could arise. I'm very careful around that one. You know, well, actually, what's all behind all that? You know, behind all that, maybe it's really just something, our wish for the end of suffering. Beautiful, beautiful, but you won't find it that place. But actually, in the same place, you just shake down the vision a little bit, and say, oh, this is the place where I can feel my impatience, or my fearfulness, or my righteousness, and handle that stuff. And handling it in a way that's no longer even sodden with shame and guilt and regret, but just this is what it is to be human, this is the vipaka we have. And then the energy of that opens us up as it discharges, we feel opened, and that lovingness and that inspiration is then released into something that supports our path. So it's more than just something doesn't occur, but something does occur, that out of the crucible of our suffering arises warmth, humour, kindness, love, energy, resilience, and so on. So all those emotional charges get transmuted into something very supportive if we know how to handle them. I find more and more in my own practice, as I figure out how do I handle this, this very body becomes important. To realize at a certain point when I'm not handling stuff, I'm losing my body. I'm going up into my head. I don't know which is internal and external anymore. I'm not certain whether this feeling I have is really because of you or is because of me. Whether it's my stuff or your stuff, whether it's really your fault, you're so clumsy and inadequate, or whether it's me being demanding or in a bad mood. I lose all that. And I'm out in the spin of it all. Really important to feel the feeling as it's expressed in the bodily sense, holding it into, we can feel the charge, the tension, the pushing, the sinking in our own embodied sense, and being able to hold it there till it releases. Because otherwise it gets very difficult for us to know whether something's internal or external. It gets all mixed up. But in this body, you begin to find a way to know how much of this is my own stuff and how much of it's what's happening around me and where's the place of release. And what seems more and more to arise for myself in that process is sort of two emotional movements that seem to be really genuine. Out of the confusion and the delusion and the retraction and the withdrawals and the fears and the running away and the getting upset and all that, there's two seem to come out that are actually authentic. One is the thankfulness, sense of thankfulness for the opportunity, for this possibility, for the friendships, for the occasions, and for whatever externally, and for whatever strengths and qualities have occurred, arisen internally. I feel grateful for that, to not lose the gratitude, to drink in the gratitude, to be able to abide in that. Very satisfying. And the other is compassion, the sense of, for what has not been resolved yet externally, the frustrations or the inadequacies externally and internally, the confusions and the blunderings internally, compassion rather than anxiety and blame. That's also very beautiful. Something that keeps one wishing to explore the edge of suffering for one's own welfare. And it's through this that whole field of welfare, the field of blessings, opens out into something that we can all share in, compassion. Realizing that all of this, all of the forms we have, the Vajrayana, the Mahayana, the Theravada, all the lineages, all the schools, all the Abhidharmas, the Vinaya, the suttas, the sutras, the shastras, the commentaries, the tikkas, the sub-commentaries, and so forth, all arose from one person sitting under a tree. And putting an end to his suffering. A big, big space, huge space from that. Didn't have to figure out as he's sitting under the tree. Let me think. We're in 2,500 years' time with this, and then again next year, and then after that, and the bhikkhus will probably be like that, and then we're going to do the nuns. Because the lay folk in America, we're making sure they're going to go. And again, nobody would blame me if I didn't do that right. So, sitting under a tree, breathing in, breathing out. And really wonderful to be part of that Buddha dispensation. So offer this for your reflection.
Annamayam Uvadagata Sadhukaranga Namah.